This is an I Am Listening original podcast.
For us, I think it was very much, you've lost a baby, you'll be fine, you can go on to have more children. And it was just heartbreaking to have that kind of outlook. There was no empathy or understanding. And things have changed since we lost Abigail for the better. So that's the most important thing.
Welcome to Series 2 of A Journey with Abigail's Footsteps, a podcast about the difference this baby loss charity is making to lives across the country. I'm Nicola Everett, a proud ambassador of Abigail's Footsteps, a charity that supports families at the most difficult time and provides training for healthcare professionals. Sadly, in the UK, it's estimated that one in four pregnancies ends in the loss of a baby. Despite that figure, it's still something people find difficult to talk about, and parents can face a wall of silence. We're hoping this series of podcasts will break down that wall. Parents will share their own experiences, which at times can be difficult to listen to, but we'll also share their inspirational stories of resilience and hope, and how you can get involved in making a difference to so many amazing families. Welcome to episode one, where I'm joined by Jo Ward, Abigail's mum and one of the co-founders of Abigail's Footsteps. We also hear about the bereavement suite set up at Medway Maritime Hospital in Abigail's name to help other bereaved parents. I'm delighted to be joined on this episode of the podcast by Jo Ward, co-founder of Abigail's Footsteps and Abigail's mum. Jo, thanks ever so much for being on the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
I wonder if you can take us back to the time after you lost Abigail. And when was it that you decided you wanted to do something more to help other people and really to keep Abigail's name alive?
I do think it was quite early on, because sort of what we went through was quite traumatic, and it was very much a case of, if we've had to go through it, I don't want others to. So it gave me the strength to keep going, in all honesty. If I hadn't had that reason to carry on, I don't know if I would have done, but I had to do it in Abigail's memory, do something to a legacy for her, to make her proud. And I think that was the driving force behind the charity.
You mentioned there how traumatic things were for you. Would you mind telling us a little bit about what you went through? I appreciate it's not an easy thing to talk about.
No, even all these years later, it's still as raw as the day that we lost her. To get to sort of my due date, everything, it's just, you know, it's going to be all okay. And it wasn't. And that's when our world just came crashing down, to be honest. I never even gave it a second thought that something could go wrong. And to lose her at 41 weeks and to go into a hospital that wasn't equipped to deal with a stillbirth, I was very much put in a cupboard, in a room off of the main ward. I'm trying to process that I've lost my daughter, and all I can hear is that the hustle and bustle outside. It was very obvious that the midwives didn't know how to deal with me, or didn't want to, because it was traumatic for them as well. And I understand that. But I did feel a bit of an outcast. It was a bit surreal. It wasn't happening to me. It couldn't be happening to me. Why were all these other mums on the ward that I could see and hear with their babies? And I wasn't gonna have mine.
Obviously, there's that huge emotion of grief. But was there also anger, resentment? Can you describe how you were feeling? It almost sounded like it was a bit of an out-of-body experience. And you were just like, you know, I can't quite comprehend what's going on.
Very much so. It wasn't real. During sort of the pregnancy, you know, I would worry, I'd be going to get checked and they'd be, yeah, it's all okay. But to go that last time and them to actually say, no, there is no heartbeat. It was like, no, you always say everything's fine. And to be told it actually wasn't, the words still aren't there, even all this time later. It's hard to put into words.
We spoke to your husband, David, in the first series of the podcast, and he told us in real detail about the time that you were there in the hospital, and perhaps some of the things that resonated most was the fact you could hear other babies crying because you weren't taken to anywhere separate so that you could deal with things. And also the fact that people just said
the wrong thing. I presume, as you say, all these years later, those things you still remember to this very day.
Oh, they don't go away. When we found out that there was no heartbeat and, you know, Abigail had gone, the next morning we had to go. So we had to go home. The next morning we had to be back at the hospital, and I had to go on to the antenatal unit to have my scan. And it just felt like a stab in the back that, you know, I'd lost my baby and I've got all these exciting mums going for their scans to see everything. And it just seemed cruel. I just thought, why couldn't they have taken me to a side room? Why couldn't they have done it out of hours? Why? It's just, you know, a little bit of thought and care would have made that experience so much better for me. Oh, and even sort of letting the ward know that I was coming. So I remember walking through and this cleaner could see that I was upset. And she was very much, well, don't worry, dear, it'll be fine. You know, you're having a baby, you'll be all right. Not knowing that I wasn't going to have a baby.
We spoke to David as well about, you know, how the pair of you cope together. And you are an incredibly, if you don't mind me saying, you seem to be an incredibly strong couple. And to go through something like you did, I mean, how did you support each other, do you think? How did David support you, and how did you support him as well as Abigail's dad?
We always do joke that, you know, we're the A team, we're stronger together. And a lot of parents in these situations, they do fall apart and, you know, move away from each other because you're not looking to blame one another, but that blame does come in. And we didn't do that. We very much sort of pulled together. He'd have a good day, I'd have a bad day, and vice versa. And you just have to be there for each other. And it was a case of, we've got to turn this into something positive for Abigail. We can't forget her. And that's why this sort of the charity developed. But for David, it was, you know, he was the father, the man, he should be the brave one. And I think that made me sort of step up a little bit to support him, because he was grieving just as much as me. Even though I'd carried Abigail for 9 months, he was still her dad.
And were you both united in that idea of setting up a charity? Is it something that you both really agreed on at the very start, that is what you were going to do?
Very much so. For both of us, it was that focus to keep going. So it again brought us together, which made us, you know, move forward as a couple. So it was definitely a shared vision that we would do that for Abigail, yes.
And what was the initial thought? What did you want to achieve initially?
So we were just, mum and dad, just going to raise a little bit of money. And that was very much it. There was never any big plans. It was just something to give us something back to the community and to hopefully, you know, avoid just one other person having to go through what we did. So there was never any of that ambition for it to become the national charity and do the amazing work that it's doing. It's phenomenal, and we are so extremely proud now. But at the time, it was just something quite small. Never saw it having sort of this sort of longevity. And yeah, it's strange looking back how the charity has evolved.
Yeah, and it has evolved hugely. As you say now, it's known across the whole country. You're doing so much good work. Do you want to just explain some of the things that Abigail's does and some of the things you're really proud of?
We've got a fantastic team, loads of volunteers, but the charity as a whole, offering that counselling, which is something that wasn't offered to us at that time. So to reach out to so many families and just be there and offer that support sort of during this process that they're going through. And with Abigail, we didn't get to spend much time with her because sadly she had passed, and it was at least another 48 hours until I delivered her. So we weren't able to sort of spend a great deal of time, and there were no cold cots, which is something that has been our main focus, that we can have these cold cots in as many hospitals throughout the UK, so mums can spend time, create memories with their babies, and that's something that I didn't get to do.
And those cold cots have made such a huge difference, haven't they? You must really love to hear from people who've been able to use one of those cold cots and for them to tell you what a difference it has made.
It's actually quite a sad experience, really, because the amount of people that do say, I know someone that's used Abigail's place. And in all honesty, I'd rather no one had to use it. But sadly, so many people going through a stillbirth. So to have Abigail's place and the cold cots, where these families, mum, dad, siblings, grandparents, they all get to create that bond with the baby, have photos, and that will last a lifetime for those families. So that's where I'm immensely proud of the charity in Abigail's, in her memory.
We should probably, for anybody who doesn't know about Abigail's Place specifically, they may have heard of an Abbey Cot or the Cold Cots. Would you mind describing what Abigail's Place is like and where it is?
So it's close enough to the maternity ward, but it's not in the maternity ward, where when I was there, I was literally in a small, tiny room. There was no bed for David. He just had to sleep in an armchair next to me for the sort of 4 or 5 days that we were there. They'd sort of open the door and you'd see people going past with their balloons. It's a boy, it's a girl, with the babies crying. So that was extremely hard. So when we found a room at the end of the corridor, we were able to fundraise and make provisions to create Abigail's Place, which would have a bedroom, a front room, a kitchen facilities. So medical support was close enough, but it was a retreat, a safe haven for these families after sort of losing their child. So that is something we're very proud of. And also sort of Medway Hospital, it's a fantastic facility, and it's offered so much comfort to so many families.
You mentioned there that you obviously, you hope no one ever has to use the facilities. Sadly, they do have to, and that you'd probably hope that they'd never heard of your charity. But an awful lot of people, they have said to us, you know, we'd never heard of Abigail's Footsteps until we went through our own grief and losing a baby. But my goodness, they're so grateful that you were there. And the counselling in particular, as you mentioned, I mean, that has just been incredible to so many parents and wider family as well, because they're just as affected by the loss of a baby, aren't they?
Very much so. You know, for some grandparents, it's their first grandchild and they're grieving. So, you know, the charity brings all of the family together, and it's about acknowledging that baby, that they did exist. They are important. They are part of the family. For us, I think it was very much, you've lost a baby, you'll be fine, you can go on to have more children. And it was just heartbreaking to have that kind of outlook. There was no empathy or understanding. And things have changed since we lost Abigail for the better. So that's the most important thing.
You admit that you never imagined the charity would grow as it has, or maybe even go on for as long as it has. Do you have plans for the future, Jo, or do you just kind of take each day as it comes and see what happens with the charity?
I think it's very much take each day as it comes, but we have so many amazing supporters that are out there raising funds, wanting to raise funds for cold cots for the hospitals where they were with their children, and sort of the word of mouth and the amount of people that have just bought into what we're doing, because for so long it was such a taboo subject. You know, we can't talk about it, oh, she's lost a baby, let's change the subject. And, you know, I wanted to shout about having Abigail. You know, I just had a baby, I was very proud, and a lot of people didn't know how to talk to me, didn't want to ask questions, and that hurt, because I wanted them to ask and for to make her significant. The amount of people that would avoid me, and I think that's where the charity has changed it. It's making it affects so many people, and it's just getting people to talk.
Abigail would have been 15 now, and obviously you get to say her name every single day. How does that feel?
She's very much a big part of the family. We now have Reuben and Betty, so she is the big sister. I think she'd be very proud of sort of her siblings, but her legacy is just amazing, and we are so very proud.
Jo, thank you ever so much for joining us on this episode of the podcast. It's been fantastic speaking to you.
No, thank you very much, and thank you to everyone for supporting Abigail's.
Baby loss charity Abigail's Footsteps offers counselling for grieving parents and specialist bereavement training for midwives and healthcare professionals. With compassion and care, Abigail's Footsteps has provided solace to countless bereaved families across Kent and the UK. Their Abbey cooling cots have allowed hundreds of parents to cherish precious moments and make memories with their baby, additional time they thought they might never have. Your generous support help and donations will make all the difference in enabling this incredible Kent charity to continue their invaluable services. To learn how you can make a meaningful difference and support Abigail's Footsteps, visit their website at abigailsfootsteps.co.uk.
Next on this episode, we can hear from Lynn Sheridan and Karen McIntyre, who are trustees of Abigail's Footsteps.
Thank you both ever so much for being on this episode of the podcast. It's fantastic to speak to you because you have a huge amount of experience in your field, but also in the setting up of Abigail's Place. Firstly, I think perhaps for anybody who doesn't know about Abigail's Place and doesn't know what that facility is, would you mind just explaining it to us and maybe how the concept was first introduced to you?
Okay, so shall I explain Abigail's Place first? So it's a self-contained area which consists of a kitchen, a bathroom, a beautiful lounge area and a bedroom. We also have a small office to the side which we use for different facilities related to the bereavement pathway. And probably the best person to talk about how it came to fruition, if you like, is probably Lynn. But I just want to give a view that the place itself is a beautiful, calming, peaceful environment. And what it does allow is it allows mums and their partners and their families that once they've had their baby, they can spend time together as a family, away from the busyness of the delivery suite, away from the busyness of the hospital, and just be together and take those moments of being with their baby and appreciating them all being together. It really is beautiful. When you go inside, that's what all mums and their families say, how calming it is and how peaceful it is. And that just helps them, obviously, spiritually as well.
Yeah, we should probably make it clear, this is within a hospital, but it certainly doesn't feel like it's in a hospital No. once you're in that environment.
That's
it?
Right. It's at the end of a corridor. So you've got the delivery suite towards at the other end of the corridor. But as you walk in, it feels like a self-contained, separate environment. I've never seen anything like it in any other hospital. It's beautiful.
Lynn, how were you first approached about it and kind of how did you take that idea forward?
Okay, so we were in the middle of a large piece of development work within the trust, and particularly in the Women's and Children's Directorate. And one of the senior midwives came to see me one day. I hadn't been with the team that long at the time. And she said, "You've got to meet this guy." She said, "He's called David Warden. He's from Abigail's Footsteps." And she said, "You know, he is absolutely passionate about helping to improve the lot for parents that have had the sad event of losing a baby." So we got David in and we invited him along to one of our development team meetings because we thought we could really learn from his experience. David had been involved with the trust for a while, but he was absolutely passionate about getting an environment away from the delivery suite, away from any hurly-burly of labour and, you know, happy parents and visiting relatives that could be used for parents that needed time and space. So we invited him along. He told us his story, his story and Joe's story. And, you know, you could have heard a pin drop, really. He explained to us how it felt from the perspective of a parent. And whilst the clinical teams knew this very well, I think the wider team, including trust departments like estates and facilities, finance, you know, all the rest of the trust, were really captivated by what he said. So we made it one of our highest priorities to get this sorted out. And over the course of a few months, we developed a project plan. We had to find the space, which wasn't easy. As I'm sure you can imagine, space is a premium in any hospital. And there's a queue of about 8 departments all fighting over the same square foot. So we managed to find some rooms that were adjacent to the unit, but not exactly on the unit, as Karen said. They were down the corridor, but close enough that the clinical teams were accessible. They were 3 fairly large on-call rooms that had been used by junior doctors over the history of the hospital. Because of the way junior doctors' practice had changed, the on-call rooms were being used less and less frequently because they'd moved to more of a sort of shift pattern. So we sort of stuck our post-it note on the door of them, claimed the space, and went to see the exec team within the trust. And we were really well supported. The chair was an advocate for Abigail's Footsteps. We brought the team down, they saw the space, And whilst there were other bidders for that area, I think we won basically on, you know, emotional grounds, if nothing else, but particularly the need for, you know, maternity patients to have that type of facility. We were also helped by the fact that it was nationally very much in the spotlight. So we used every single piece of ammo we could find to make a very strong business case for the unit, and we were successful. So that's how it originally came about. But I think David being David, I think, you know, I think the saying goes, you don't say no to David.
And that's very true.
That's very true.
That is very true.
I sort of remember lots of walking around. Do you, Lynn?
I do.
Sort of walking around the area that we had sort of spotted and thought that would be absolutely ideal, and sort of trying to do it secretively with an idea of what was in our head. But obviously, once we came out to the trust board and said, this is what we wanted to do, as Lynn said, we got a lot of support. But it's just ideally situated there at the end of the corridor.
And the other good thing was patient involvement was very topical at the time, and having David on our project board was great, because, you know, he could keep us on an even keel and, you know, make sure what we were planning was right. And all of his contacts, which he has thousands, you know, providing all the donated kit and equipment that we needed. It wasn't a complete smooth ride, because obviously everything had to be hospital standard, fireproof, infection control compliant. So, you know, furniture companies were literally throwing stuff at us. And with the help of the estates team, we managed to work our way through all of that sort of red tape and, you know, difficulty in identifying what would be appropriate, but also what would be homely. Mm. And I think if you went in there, I don't know if you've seen it, Nicola, but it does look like a home from home. You wouldn't know you were in a hospital. Mm. And it is beautifully and tastefully decorated.
Mm. Obviously, David and Joe went through an awful experience, but how much of a difference have they made just from speaking out and saying, this cannot continue?
I think they've made a huge difference, because unfortunately we can't change their experience. But what we've been able to do is put a legacy in place. Joe and David have put a legacy in place so that other families that will go through the sad loss of a baby will have a very different experience. So I think it's hugely appreciated. You know, we get such good feedback. We got such good feedback from families to say they just wanted that time and space, as Lynn said, away from the busyness of a delivery suite, which is mostly a joyful place. However, they wanted that time where they could just all be together, and weren't ready to go home at that point. Just wanted to feel safe in a hospital so that they knew that somebody was there if they needed them, but they just wanted all to be together with their baby. So they've made a huge legacy. They've made it very different for the ladies that come to Medway Hospital.
And yeah, not just the mums, the entire family as well, because they're able to visit Abigail's place, aren't they? To meet baby, spend time with baby
absolutely.
As a wider family.
Yeah, siblings can stay over. There's plenty of room. You know, there's bed facilities for brothers and sisters, you know, aunts and uncles can come, grandparents, you know, it's there's no limit on who attends, but families can all stay overnight. Yeah.
And as Lynn says, that's so important, because the expectation of taking your baby home isn't going to be there for those families. But what they can therefore do is have everybody come and meet their baby who they wish to come and meet their baby in an environment which is just peaceful and calm. So it is not just for the parents, it's for the wider family as well, the extended and family and friends.
Some people might think, okay, well, I can spend a night there, but it's actually more than that, isn't it? It's really quite, you know, you work with the family depending on their needs rather than, you know, say, well, okay, we need the bed free. I mean, it's not that sort of facility.
No, what we really didn't want to do is have a rushed environment for anybody. We wanted people to have the beauty of Abigail's place, and then when they're ready to then go home. So it's a facility that is just so beneficial, because there might be times when we might have other mothers that might need to use the facility, but they're usually rare. So we don't say it's a one overnight stay. It's a conversation around, what do you need? How long do you need to be with us? And then also, how do we support you when you do go home? Because that's the other element to it as well that Abigail's does so well.
Yeah, absolutely. We've spoken to the counselling team who provide such amazing support. Mm. And we've spoken to an awful lot of parents who perhaps didn't realise at the time how much they'd benefited from spending time with baby. Because for some, it might not be a nice thought to be spending time with a baby that's passed, but actually when they look back, it's so incredibly important that they've made those memories.
We hear stories of families that, you know, they sit and read books to the baby, you know, they get to know their baby. Mm-hmm. And it's not just taken away from them within hours of delivery. Yeah. You know, they can spend up, you know, 3 or 4 days mm-hmm. With their child if they want to. Yeah. And when we did the conference last year, we had a lot of parent speakers. We did a fairly big conference up in London. And I don't think there was a dry eye in the house because they all explain what their own experience had been. And negative and positive. So we heard from parents who didn't have that type of opportunity and how it's left them feeling, and they'll never forget that for the rest of their lives. And families that have had the experience of Abigail's Place and others around the country that have got, you know, similar types of facility, and, you know, but I don't think to the standard that Medway Hospital have got. I mean, on that note, it has got a CQC gold standard. You know, we got outstanding for the unit, which, you know, is quite unheard of, really. So it is quite a, you know, a jewel in the crown. But going back to what you said about, you know, what David and Joe have done, the legacy-wise through their work, it's so far-reaching. You know, it's not just the physical environment of Abigail's Place. It's the bereavement training for staff. It's the counselling for parents, the provision of the Abbey cold cots, which are obviously a big part of the equipment used in the Abigail's Place environment. They just have changed the face, I think, of certainly locally, of bereavement care. They've made a massive impact on bereavement.
How nice would it be to have an Abigail's Place in every maternity unit?
I think that's David and Joe's dream, really, if they could see that facility everywhere. And we try, you know, we do work with hospitals. We're working with two of our local trusts at the moment who are constrained by space and funds and everything else. But, you know, Abigail's can provide the wherewithal, the funding and the expertise. The trust needs to find the space. And that's not an easy ask at the moment.
And I think it's definitely us as trustees now, that's an ambition for us, isn't it? How do we get that same experience for any woman family that is delivering, sadly, a baby that has passed away, and that they have exactly the same standard that the mums have at Medway?
Because unfortunately, it does happen very, very regularly. You know, families do need these facilities, don't they? Wherever they are in the country.
Exactly right.
The other thing it's very helpful for is when it's not occupied, it can be used for anything associated with bereavement. So pregnancy loss clinics are held in the lounge when there's nobody using it. There's a consulting room, as Karen said, that we built as part of the unit, which is for breaking bad news and stuff like that. So there's not somebody who's staying in the facility, but it's used because it's a adjacent to, it's away from the hurly-burly of the unit. So it has other purposes as well. But that calm environment is what's nationally prescribed, really. Any guidance that you read talk about having a separate, quiet, calm environment for anything like that, breaking sad news or post-care.
Yeah, because speaking to David and Joe, I think perhaps some of the most powerful things they said was hearing the noise of other people's babies crying. Yeah. And I mean, that really is awful to hear, isn't it? And that they went through that.
It is.
And seeing families coming in with balloons and congratulations and all the hooping and the whooping and oh, isn't he lovely and she gorgeous?
And there that family is realising that they've just lost their baby and they're in that environment. It must be so, so awful for them.
Yeah. So now both as trustees, you have a huge role within Abigail's Footsteps. You've mentioned a little bit about what you would like to achieve, but what else would you like to see going forward? Because maternity really has been under the spotlight. There's been an awful lot of talk about maternity care generally across the whole country. But as within your role as Abigail's, what would you personally like to do?
Well, we've just produced a 3 to 5 year strategy on exactly that, Nicola. So it describes in all its pages what we would like to do. I think in summary, the aim is to reach beyond the boundaries of where we are now, sort of philosophically and geographically. So, you know, the aim to become, I think the words David would use, as a challenger and an innovator and an influencer, so that we can help push the boundaries with organisations like SANS and Tommy's, help to campaign for things that, you know, women and families in that situation need, support the national guidance and the recommendations that are coming out of the numerous reviews that are being done around the country, but also to spread our services outside of, you know, the southeast and Essex, which is where we currently provide, and keep the standards that we adhere to upheld as well. You know, things like making sure there's a standard job description for a bereavement midwife, for instance, with the experience of families that have lost their babies. That sort of thing is really valuable. And there's all sorts of guidance and recommendations that have come from the national reviews. And if we could get involved in that more, which we're starting to do, working with organisations like the CQC, the RCM and the bigger national bereavement charities, it's really spreading our wings really more.
That's how I see it, Lynn, as well, because I'm new to the charity. Yeah. I've only just become a trustee. So for me, I've been struck by obviously having known David for 8 years now, probably a little bit longer, I've been struck by his still drive and motivation. But also when I went to the board meeting only last month, exactly the same. Every trustee is like, you know, we're going to keep going. And it's about that high profile, isn't it? And just making sure that that is on the agenda and just making sure that it is just not accepted if we're not at a standard that perhaps we should be. So I think that's how I see it, is maintaining that high profile and just driving forward all the time, which obviously takes some resilience and some drive and some energy. But I felt that the trustees had that in abundance. So I was really pleased to join them.
And David's developed the board over the last couple of years and brought in a lot more expertise as well. So there's a bigger number of trustees now, but the breadth of experience among them, we think we're probably about there in terms of all the bits that we might need to get the right sort of ingredients to be able to become a challenger and influencer and, you know, help to push the boundaries a bit harder.
I don't think David or Joe ever anticipated that Abigail's Footsteps would have done what it's done. But as you mentioned, the legacy is just incredible, isn't it? And to go on to build that in the years to come is going to be fantastic.
Yeah. I think it's once you start something that is so beneficial to other families as well, then it grows momentum, doesn't it? And, you know, women will talk to women and in area and outside of area as well. And therefore, it just develops. I didn't think it would be as it was 8 years ago. And I just think it's remarkable that it still is. I was still at the hospital last week and I went up to the suite to have another look. And it really is just as beautiful as the first day, which says a lot because, you know, it's been there for a long time now. So it's lovely.
Fantastic. Both of you, thank you so much for being on this episode of the podcast. And thank
you welcome.
Ever so much for the work that you do with Abigail's and will continue to do in future. Thank you.
Thanks. That's okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you ever so much to my guests. And on episode 2, we'll be hearing about twin and triplet loss. Thanks for listening to A Journey with Abigail's Footsteps. If you'd like more information about Abigail's Footsteps or how you can make a difference by supporting or donating, please click abigailsfootsteps.co.uk or follow us on social media.
This has been an I Am Listening original podcast. For more information, head over to our website, iam-listening.co.uk.